My name is Lynn Olson. Today's date is April 8th, 1986, and the following is an interview with Sidney L. Gulick, Emeritus Professor of English and Dean of Arts and Sciences from 1945 to 1969 at San Diego State University. The interview is being conducted in the Breidegard Room of the University Library Building.
Before you start,
I've already recorded my introductory message. What I want to start out then asking you is, when and where were you born?
I was born in Kobe, Japan, on August 17th, 1902.
Uh-huh. How long did you live in Japan?
I lived there until I was nearly 11, although there had been 2 years when I was young when I was gone, from 1904 to 1906. Came to America. Father was a missionary. We came on his furlough, and then he had occasion to study in Germany. Well, I'll be more specific. He had been asked to be professor of philosophy and church history and whatever else, I don't know, theological subjects, at the Doshisha University in Kyoto. And he said, I'm not trained to be a teacher. I'll have to have 2 years of study before I can do it. So they said, all right, you take your 2 years of study. And that was in 1904. He had 1 year in America and then 1 year in Germany, and the family went with him. I was the youngest of five children, so that I was two when we left Japan, and I was four when we returned. Then in 1913, Father, just before Christmas of 1912, Father had cancer, and the operation seemed to be a success. And later on seemed not to be a success, so we very suddenly left Japan because the doctor who had operated originally was no longer there, came to this country, and on board ship, Father suddenly realized what had happened. Here, the operation had been in December, here it was June, and he had felt sensitivity at the place of the operation. And so that's what he went to the doctors, and they said, oh, we won't touch it. Mm. So he came back to this country, and on board ship he suddenly realized he changed from his winter to his summer underwear. And the scar wasn't used to the summer underwear and was sensitive. All right. So we came back in this country, and he found a lot to do. He was interested in international justice, goodwill. He was concerned about growing tensions in 1913 between Japan and America, mm-hmm. and he went around talking, trying to get understanding. Recently, there's been published a biography of my father called Advocate of Understanding, and it gives a long story about him. It's a very fine book, I think.
Who was the author?
Sandra Publisher. Taylor. T-A-Y-L-O-R, Sandra. She's professor of history at the University of Utah, published by Kent State University Press. And
so your father had quite an impact.
He had an impact. He wrote 20 or 25 books, of which several were in Japanese.
He was fluent in Japanese. How nice.
He was.
What was his name? I didn't ask.
Same as mine, Sidney. And I can go on. I'll talk a long time about it because he was interested, among other things, in trying to get children to understand. You get peace from the hearts of children. Mm-hmm. So he had a Dolls of Friendship, a lot of school children in America back in 1926. They bought and dressed and sent to Japan, the children of Japan, some 13,000 dolls. And they had quite an impact at the time.
Was this the beginning of the doll exchange between
Correct.
Yokohama and San
That's
Diego?
Right. They suddenly discovered that 50 years ago or 60 years ago there had been these dolls to Japan, and they didn't realize that the Japanese had sent dolls in 1928 or so. And now, so this whole thing's going on, and when they discovered that I, the son, I'd actually touched some of the dolls. They were ecstatic here. I mean, and so they invited me to go to the doll museum opening end of May, and I can't make it. So my son, who's Sydney the Third, is going to represent us.
I didn't realize that was coming up.
It's coming up.
Maybe I should call the president of the Yokohama Society. I haven't seen
Marge
her.
Wells?
Yes, yes.
I was on
that
board.
I wasn't going to ask you questions about the Yokohama, or San Diego, yeah. Yokohama Sister City Society now, but maybe I should, since we're on that subject.
I was 25 years on the board.
Can you tell me about some of the big projects that you worked on with the society?
No, you ask Marge Wells.
She's very much involved, that's true.
Yeah, yes, I did not do much. I went to the meetings. I told them I couldn't do much, but I'd be happy to. I attended the meetings, and mm-hmm. I have something on any committee in which I serve. I always feel as though I have a duty as a facilitator. I have some expertise in parliamentary procedures, and I can often find a shortcut to get something done, move mm-hmm. something or other. People mm-hmm. begin talking, getting nowhere. So I will make the proper motion. It's not my idea, but I'm trying to speed things up.
Steer it in the right.
And I'm often, I think, useful in that way.
Yes.
Well,
would you tell me a little bit about your mother?
My mother?
Yeah, and her name and what
all
she
right,
did.
My mother's name. Mother was Kara May Fisher. Father was born in the South Sea Islands in 1860, and she was born in Detroit in 1861.
What were the name of the islands again? Where your father was
the
born?
The island of Ebon, E-B-O-N, in the Marshall Islands.
Okay.
His father had been born in Hawaii, in the Kingdom of Hawaii. And we obtained our American citizenship from my great-grandfather, Peter Johnson Dewey, who was actually born in America, in New Jersey, in 1797. Peter Johnson Gulick is buried in Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the list here. There are some 8 or 10 members of the Gulick family, one time or another, were in Japan, including, he went there in old age to live with a son.
Very strong interest in Japan. It's very
strong interest in missions, of course.
Yes.
My great-grandfather, Peter Johnson Gulick, had 7 sons and a daughter. And all those who lived to grow up, all but one, were missionaries somewhere or other. The eldest of the children was my grandfather, Luther Halsey Gulick, born in 1828 and died in the 90s. He was a medical missionary, and so my father was his third child, his eldest son. This can go on too long and be boring.
It can go on very
long. There's no point in it, but I'm saying that I had this. You asked about my background, and I'm giving you that background.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Oberlin College, where I graduated in 1923, and then that following year, not knowing what I wanted to do, I went to Japan for a year to see if I wanted to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to get there just 8 days before the big earthquake of 1923, so that my plans to study Japanese in Tokyo and earn my living by teaching English were knocked into a cocked hat. The money disappeared completely. So
you were there for one year?
I was there for a year. I went to Kyoto, stayed with friends, taught in a girls' school 2 days a week, and then Goshen University 3 days a week, one day of which I was teaching piano.
Mm-hmm.
And then I earned enough money to come home, so I came home and went on to graduate school, got a master's at Oberlin mm-hmm. in 25, then I taught at Berkeley 27 to 30.
Did you always have the idea that you're going to go into English? Or did you toss around the idea of something of studying something else?
I didn't know what I was going to do. People would ask me, are you going into the kind of thing your father did? I said, I don't know. After all, it was a missionary family, and when I went to college, I sort of, I had in high school discovered, or been discovered by, an English teacher, and encouraged somewhat by her, and then I discovered some poetry.
So and you were...
Keats and Shelley, and I sort of wanted to be a poet, and there was, but not very much. I didn't know quite what to, how to go about it, really. And as a freshman in college, I took usual college courses, had to have science, I took chemistry. I'm delighted in chemistry. I decided I was going to be a chemist. And so my sophomore year in college, I took the third year college chemistry, having been too smart to do the second year, which was analytic. I took the organic chemistry right off, and became decreasingly effective. And and I discovered, I always said it, and it's in a non-religious sense, that in chemistry I was losing my soul. Not religious soul, but the it was mechanical, it was rigorous, and I could do that. I could handle the mathematics. I had some calculus to find out what it was calculus about, and I didn't. And then I had some good English teachers. So I shifted into an English major, writing a little bit, but not successfully. And so one of them said to me in my senior year that he thought I might have the makings of a scholar, might be teaching, going into English. Well, that didn't bear fruit immediately because I went to Japan for a year. But then I went back to Oberlin and got a master's in English. And because my teachers, some of my teachers there had been to Yale, they recommended Yale to me, and I applied, not thinking there was any problem getting anywhere, and I was accepted. Things were very casual and easy in those days. So that I sort of went into being attempting to be a scholar, and I went to Yale, and I found that it was fun, enjoyable. I worked terribly hard. I had eye trouble, so I couldn't read as well as I liked to, and I nevertheless I survived when many of them didn't survive there. But after 2 years, I had completed the necessary coursework for the PhD, and since I already had an MA, I was going to try to get another MA at Yale. No point doing that. This is 1927. Sort of stirrings within me, and it seemed desirable for me to get a job. So I went to the office there and said I'd be interested. And they said, well, there's going to be a man from Berkeley coming by, and made an appointment for him. I wouldn't say for me to see him. He came to the room where I was in the dormitory. Talked very pleasantly, and he found out that I was very fond of John Henry Newman, and I didn't know it at the time. He was an Irish Catholic. The fact that I was interested in Newman meant that I must be the right stuff. I was an arrant Protestant. However, so he hired me. I thought I was going to teach English at Berkeley. When I got there, found out that I'd been hired to teach public speaking. I'd never had any public speaking.
Well, you discovered that when you got there.
When I got there.
What did you do about it?
I taught
that
it.
Time? You had to suddenly jump right into
it. Well,
what
he said was, we do about the same thing we were required to do it. The students, you give them assignments and let them talk. But he recommended a book, and I used it as my textbook, a volume of essays written in the 19th century. And so we had them read them, and then by his methods, which were very sound, I had each student write a summary, one sentence for each paragraph in the other. The students complained because that was terribly hard work, and it is. I said to them, you don't know half how hard it is. It's twice as hard for me because I have to know what you're trying to say. So, later on, I'll tell you, I had one of the students come back to me some years later, happened to see me. He made the effort to come. I wasn't teaching at Berkeley anymore. I was in Mills College in Oakland, to tell me that that was the best thing that ever happened to me. He was an MD. So this is the best thing that ever happened to me.
It's very satisfying to have a student come back and tell you that.
I didn't have very many who did that. However, so I taught there 3 years, but I did not have the doctorate.
Did you teach anything other than
I taught
speech?
Only, all I was hired to teach was freshman public speaking. And I learned how to do it. One of the men in the department took me in hand, gave me hints, told me some stories, anecdotes, how to do it. And I became, if I do say so, a good teacher, because he knew things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a whole set of good jokes, which were useful. Not terrible, I mean, little things here and there. One is sort of immodest, but I will tell you. People have a habit. They don't know what to do with their hands. So they clasp in front of them. And that's not very good. And so he would say, and I use it only once, but intensely effective, a young man, I said, if I were you, I should abandon the fig leaf gesture.
And what did the young man do? What did he
blushed
say?
And abandoned it.
Did you use that only once?
I used it only once. He'd used it before. He told me that kind of thing. Yeah.
I'd be tempted to try that again.
Well, no, I think nobody else did.
Then you moved on to Mills College.
Then I went back to Yale to finish my degree.
That's okay.
I went to there's a man by the name of Tinker, Chauncey Brewster Tinker, who was a famous teacher and a great teacher and a great scholar. I was resentful at having to go back. I said, I like teaching. I don't want to be a scholar. I'm not a productive man. I want to be a teacher. And I've done the necessary work. I know the field. I could, I had it tried on me, and I'd do it. Give me a piece of writing, and I can judge within 25 years when it was written in English. I know the fields. And one of the smart aleck teachers at Mills College later, with a gleam in her eye, said, I have something. Like she'd heard me somehow or other, you know. I was young and brash and boastful. Well, she handed it to me, and I looked at it. I made now, I forget what it was. Guess she said, you're very close. I said, this is an imitation of so-and-so.
That's kind of a mean trick.
It was a mean trick. All right. Now, so I went back to Yale, and I had only that 1 year. The Depression had come in the meantime, and my $1,000 of savings, I sold out for $307. It's all right. My father helped me, so that was all right. But I started Tinker. I said, I don't know what to write on. I had been wanting to write on Edmund Burke, but earlier I'd been turned down for the subject, and very wisely, because the subject was too vague that I'd chosen. I didn't do a good job. He said, I have offered this to two or three other students, and they've had taken it for a day or two or a week. They come back and said, no, they don't like it. He said, but I still think there's something in it. And it was a man by the name of Chesterfield, Philip Dormer Stanhope, the fourth Earl of Chesterfield. They said they find the man repulsive, not great. Evidently.
You took it.
So this was in May of 1930. I'd taught at Berkeley 3 years, and the year ended very early in those days, as it does, well, it had ended
the semester.
In early May.
Yeah. Yes.
Because at Berkeley, they used to start in August and end in the first semester in December. Well, anyway, they're more or less back in that scheme here now. So I went to the library, Columbia University. My parents were living close to it. And I read what I could there. And that summer, I was given a trip with my parents to Europe. The father had a conference to go to. So while he was at the conference at Bournemouth, my mother was with him, I was at the British Museum for 9 days. So I had one day down at the Bodleian at Oxford. And I found editions of Chesterfield. I dug in, you see, and I began to find them. Then I went back to Yale. Yale had great collections of works in that 18th century, 1700s, which were very helpful. But to my surprise, I found that although I'd seen a lot of them at the British Museum, which had many of the early editions, and had Yale, but there were others that they didn't have at all. And a bookseller's catalog. Somebody said to me, why don't you write to Blackwell's at Oxford? So I got the name, wrote to them, say, am I interested? And they said, we have a few. And for $25, I got, I think, 7 different
really?
Editions of early Chesterfield items. Not the first edition. The first edition was expensive. It cost over $100.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, these were, and then, as a matter of fact, about a year later, they sent me, I bought another $30 or $40 worth, and I began to have a collection of Chesterfieldiana. Well, as I began to study, I began to find out. I show the example of how fine a teacher Tinker was. Here I was going to write on the publication and reception of Lord Chesterfield's letters to his son. They weren't published in his lifetime. He died. His son had died 6 years before him. His son was illegitimate, but the father loved him and tried to train him and get him going and all that. So that when Chesterfield died, shortly after his son died, knock at the door, figurative, Chesterfield's effect. A young woman turned up, about 40, and said, I am, your son is dead, I am his widow, and here are your 2 grandsons.
Oh.
Chesterfield, you know nothing about any of them. He was a gentleman, he didn't provide for her, particularly, but he provided for the grandsons, and when he on his death, his will showed money for each grandchild, and so on, so the grandsons would get somewhere enough to live on. They wouldn't have to be beggars.
Mm-hmm.
But she got nothing, so she went to a bookseller and sold the letters. Chesterfield, the famous man, none of this was really known. It was they were published by Eugenia Stanhope. And the little preface by her, but I had to dig out all of this. Now I'm talking way too long on this subject.
That's all right. Go ahead. I'm just checking the tape just to make sure we have enough. Yeah, we got plenty.
I said to Tinker, I don't know quite how to start my dissertation. I'd been studying and gathering material. Don't know how to start my dissertation. I suppose I should write a brief sketch of his life first. And, you know?
What specifically did you have in mind? Did you have any kind of
point of view? No, I had no particular point of view. I was just going to write a life of Chesterfield. And he said, if I were you, I would start with the death of Chesterfield. Saved me 2 years' labor.
Rewriting and rewriting and trying to figure out what it was.
All right.
What specifically did you write about in your...
Well, I wrote 3 chapters. I wrote, as he said, I started with the death of Chesterfield, and then the publication of letters, how they came into print,
mm-hmm.
and later on I found a lot of material nobody ever knew existed, and published it, and then I wrote about what the newspapers and magazines had to say about it. At first there was a lot of praise, then people started to say, this is awful. Talk, his bastard, his illegitimate son.
and he condones. He's not a man of principles. He's telling his boy how to get along in the world.
One way, I'm sorry I'm not in my office because I still have a few. I farmed in the course of the years the world's best collection of 18th century editions on Lord Chesterfield. And when I decided a few years ago...
Do you have his bag at that office?
Well, it's not there now. I have a few of them. A few years ago, I sold the bulk of it to Yale. At the time I sold it, I had the world's best collection. Yale had the second best collection. British Museum had almost as good as Yale.
And you had been collecting for a good part of your life then, up until just recently? Did you just sell this collection?
I sold it about 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh.
And after Yale got all it wanted, there's something it didn't want, I'd let them buy them individually. Mm-hmm. I sold another big batch to the Huntington Library. And now that the Yale has my collection, it not only has the best, but nobody could ever approach it. It's just an unapproachable collection.
Mm-hmm.
And Huntington had a fairly good collection. It now has the world's second best, possibly. Certainly the second best in America. It's hard to judge whether it would be better than the British Museum. But I had
it's
that
a
kind of collection.
I
still have a few, which I shall probably give to the library here. I don't know why I'm talking so long.
Well, I have a question, though. One question about the unpublished sources that you said that you found for your dissertation and that you published in your dissertation. Could you tell me about those a little bit?
Yeah, if you want to know about them.
Yeah, just a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Much of it was not unpublished, but it was hidden away in letters to the editor and to little comments here and there. And I went through. This is what I did at Yale. They had a collection of a set of the London Chronicle.
Mm-hmm.
It was a biweekly paper, newspaper. And they had little literary reviews in there, and they had advertisements by booksellers. They'd say, next week will be published, such and such price. Or then, this day is published, and they list it. All right. Then the word of mouth came around, and I was told that a man by the name of Temple Scott, who had been a bookseller in New York for many years, had a few years before offered to sell Yale University a collection of letters written by Lord Chesterfield to the man who succeeded him as became the fifth Earl of Chesterfield. He was his godson, and Chesterfield had no legitimate children. He had just his one son.
Mm-hmm.
He had the illegitimate child couldn't inherit. Of course, he was dead first, but if he had been legitimate, his children would have inherited the title. Now, Chesterfield, here were 250 letters that Chesterfield had written to Philip Stanhope, his son's name, but also his godson's name, who became the name Philip, more or less common in the family.
Mm-hmm.
So these letters had been published in 1890 by one of the, how can I put it, family, more or less, allied families, the Earl of Carnarvon. And they'd been offered to Yale for $10,000. Yale had not bought them. I should go to see Mr. Temple Scott, so I wrote him. He was very ill on his deathbed, as a matter of fact. But I was admitted to, I think it was the hospital where he was staying for rest home care.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what he was dying of. I think it was cancer, but he may not have been. So he talked to me. And he had sold those now to another bookseller out in just the outskirts of Chicago. Oh, right, but I take it back. In Indianapolis. So,